ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fake news, alternative facts, stolen elections. No other modern political figure has been able to rewire our relationship with the truth quite like Donald Trump. Many media outlets got it very wrong in 2016 when he staged one of the biggest upsets in American election history. Now, as he makes his case for re-election in 2024, under a cloud of criminal prosecutions, what can journalists do differently this time round to accurately and impartially report on this most unusual campaign? Welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Nick Bryant is former BBC Washington correspondent. He's met Trump. He reported on Trump's first campaign in presidency. He's author of When America Stopped Being Great, A History of the Present, a book that apparently sits on the shelf of current US President Joe Biden's Oval Office. His new book, The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself, is out soon. And in this episode of Big Ideas, Nick Bryant delivers the 2024 Brian Johns Lecture, hosted by Macquarie University's Centre for Media History and the Copyright Agency, in honour of the late Brian Johns, former Managing Director of the ABC and the Copyright Agency. So now let's hand over to Nick Bryant with his lecture, Donald Trump, American Authoritarianism, and How Journalists Should Cover It.
Thank you very much for those warm words. Thank you for turning out in such numbers. It's lovely to see such a crowd in such a wonderful setting. One of the lovely things I love about Sydney is how it continually reveals itself to you. I had no idea this auditorium even existed, so it's wonderful to be here tonight. I also want to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land and to express gratitude for the wisdom and knowledge that has been passed down over the generations for 65,000 years. I also want to acknowledge the presence of Sam Mostyn. Sam, I'm thrilled for you and I'm thrilled for Australia that you are going to be the next Governor General. As a Brit, I confess, the institution feels a little bit anachronistic and weird, but I cannot think of anybody who is better equipped to make it unweird and modern. So good luck as you take up your new role. I also want to acknowledge Brian Johns. Alas, we never met, which is a great shame because I sense that we shared the same journalistic DNA and a belief in public broadcasting, a belief that public broadcasting continually needs to be renewed, a belief that public broadcasting continually needs to be rethought, and a belief that public broadcasting continually needs to be defended. I see in Brian a kindred spirit, somebody who loved newspapers, somebody who loved broadcasting, somebody who loved books. It's great that this lecture honours his memory. I noticed that he passed away in early 2016. That was such a big bang moment for journalism around the world. It was a year of Brexit in my homeland. It was a year of the shock victory of Donald Trump. How we could have benefited from Brian Johns' wisdom and sagacity as we navigated these disorientated times, which have raised such vexed questions for the media. Certainly they weren't waters that I ever expected to navigate when, you know, I met Donald Trump in Trump Tower in 2014. It was about 9 months before he came down the golden escalator. A portal, incidentally, which many of his supporters believe was a stairway from heaven. It was actually proof that he was sent from God. And as John said, I mean, it was kind of interesting to shake his hand. I mean, Trump is a famed germaphobe. I was really worried that if I put out my hand, he wouldn't actually take it. But he not only took it, he was incredibly friendly. I mean, friendly almost to the point of obsequiousness. "It's such a great honour to meet you," he said. I mean, I really thought he got those words in the wrong order. But I think he regarded the BBC as an offshoot of the British royal family and that I was some kind of minor royal. And it was interesting as we went through to his boardroom, which is nothing like the kind of firing chamber on The Apprentice, which has those mahogany walls. It's actually quite a beautiful space with lovely views of Central Park down Fifth Avenue. And while my cameraman was sort of miking him up and fixing the lights, we were chit-chatting away, and Trump came across as very lucid and very intelligent and surprisingly humble. I mean, these were the days when he enjoyed the company of the press. He didn't regard us as fake news and enemies of the people. We were having a good time. We were getting on well. And then the camera went on, the red light went on, and Trump's persona just completely changed. He came up with these kind of crazy boasts. He came up with these crazy conspiracy theories about wind farms, the nostalgic nationalism that would become such a part of his presidential run. He spoke about that. And one of the mistakes I made when Trump was elected president was that maybe we would get the Trump that I saw before the camera went on. And of course, we got the Trump when the camera went on, times a thousand. Often the magnitude of the presidency has a humbling effect on its occupants. Lyndon Johnson spoke of how the awesome responsibility, the awesome power that you immediately gain has an instantly humbling effect. Now, of course, Donald Trump, this was very opposite. He didn't suffer from imposter syndrome at all. Indeed, in his first television interview with ABC News, the American ABC News, he likened himself already to Abraham Lincoln, the greatest president that had ever existed. We were in for the wildest of rides, which culminated, of course, with January the 6th, an attack on America spoken of rightly, in my opinion, in the same breath as September the 11th and the attack on Pearl Harbor. In the early days of his candidacy, perhaps the smartest piece of commentary came from the Atlantic writer Selena Zito, who posited that Trump supporters took him seriously, though not literally, while detractors took him literally, but not seriously. When it came to political violence, however, this formula broke down. From the outset, it was clear that MAGA diehards were prepared to act on his violent directives. January the 6th should have finished him. This was an American insurrection mounted by a sitting American president. He urged American to fight American. Yet just 7 weeks after the storming of the US Capitol came the consecration of Donald Trump at a conservative conference in Orlando that felt more like a cult conclave. Under the palm trees that lined the sidewalk outside, flora that seemed fittingly apostolic, Trump followers bellowed the former president's name through bullhorns and cheered when a mobile billboard was driven past, illuminated with what was meant to be a trolling taunt, January the 6th reunion. They loved it. It was a badge of honor. As I myself discovered, journalists who interviewed members of the crowd and pushed back against the fantasy that Trump had been the victim of some terrible electoral fraud were encircled by angry supporters with the manic energy of big lie true believers. More so than ever before, the press were the enemies of the people. It was the first time during the Trump years that I actually felt physically at risk. All religions need demons as well as prophets, and inside the convention hall, delegates could purchase Nancy Pelosi toilet paper and Not My Dictator t-shirts portraying Joe Biden with a Hitler star moustache. But here also was something we had not cast eyes on before, a gold-plated statue of Donald Trump wearing garish Old Glory swim shorts, a shining icon which looked like the 1980s had thrown up all over it. Delegates queued up to have their photos taken alongside, like giggling nuns posing next to the Pope. The climax of the event came on the final afternoon of the conference, a Sunday, fittingly, when his arrival on stage to deliver his first speech since leaving the White House felt like a celestial event. It was not so much his resurrection, however, because it was clear by now that January the 6th had not brought about his political death. Rather than being a moment of Trumpian repudiation, the failed rebellion has become a moment of further Republican radicalization. This thrice married, twice impeached, Putin admiring former playboy, who only a few weeks earlier tried to engineer an American coup, had become the leader of a quasi-religious movement. A messiah complex came together with a martyrdom complex, the sense of shared victimhood that went a long way towards explaining how a billionaire became such a working class hero. It was Trump as Godhead and Trumpism as creed. The rise of Donald Trump had demonstrated the enduring appeal of an American demagogue. Indeed, just as there was a paranoid style in American politics identified by the scholar Richard Hofstadter during the McCarthy era, there was also a demagogic tradition. Andrew Jackson, the Louisiana governor Huey Long, the red-baiting senator Joe McCarthy, the southern segregationist George Wallace. The American story has regularly featured these kind of disruptive and dangerous characters. But there's also an authoritarian style in American politics that Trump successfully harnessed. Indeed, his 4 years in office testified to the allure of an American strongman. His own personal brand of authoritarianism immediately became evident the moment he raised his right hand to take the oath of office. I was stood 50 yards away at the time. And those first 36 hours in charge were his presidency in microcosm. His inaugural address had the ranting, ultra-nationalist tone of a rally speech, more potentate than a fledgling president. His inaugural parade, he'd wanted to display martial trappings. Make it look like North Korea, he said. Tanks and choppers, rather than floats and high school marching bands. He even attempted to gaslight his compatriots into believing his inaugural crowd was the largest in history, demanding that they discount the evidence of their own eyes. All authoritarian regimes begin with an act of repression, and Trump was trying to quash the truth. We all remember what happened next. Sean Spicer, his new press secretary, was dispatched by the president to the White House briefing room, not to take questions from reporters, as ordinarily would be the case, but to bark out a statement with untrue claims about the meager crowd size. Appearing on Meet the Press the same weekend, the White House aide Kellyanne Conway introduced into the lexicon the infamous Orwellian term alternative facts. Trump's Washington instantly felt like Pyongyang on the Potomac. On his first full day in charge, Trump immediately sought to co-opt one of the nation's power ministries by heading over to the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Then, standing in front of the honor wall, commemorating agents killed defending freedom, he verbally bludgeoned the media, blasting members of the press pack as being amongst the most dishonest human beings on earth. Undermining trust in the Fourth Estate, the monitors of baseline facts, was another classic authoritarian play. More worrying, but less prominently reported than his crowd-sized deception, was his empty claim that up to 5 million votes had been cast illegally for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election, which explained why she'd outpolled him by 3 million votes. Even in victory, Trump defamed democracy, going as far as to appoint a presidential advisory commission on election integrity, which, needless to say, found no evidence of widespread fraud. Trump believed that power flowed through the tip of his Sharpie pen. Rather than focusing on advancing a legislative agenda, which he should have been able to accomplish given the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress, he instructed his White House aides to draft 200 executive orders that he could sign during his first 100 days. When the courts blocked one of his first executive orders, the Muslim travel ban, he harangued the federal judges who thwarted him, an unprecedented attack on the judiciary. From continuing to hold campaign-style rallies throughout his presidency, which no incumbent had done before, to using his Twitter feed not just as a propaganda tool, but as an instrument to project his omnipresence, Trump continued in this authoritarian vein. New federal buildings should be designed in the classical style, the architectural aesthetic of authoritarians. On July the 4th in 2019, he orchestrated a Salute to America military tattoo on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The show of a lifetime, he called it, featuring tanks, armored personnel carriers, and a flypast, including a B-2 stealth bomber, and even one of the jumbo jets used as Air Force One. Trump tried to create a continuous sense of crisis, whether it came in the form of the invasion of immigrants crossing the southern border, disturbances in Portland, Oregon, or gang-related murders in Chicago. The irony of Trump's crisis peddling was that when the country was confronted by a truly national emergency, COVID, he did his damnedest to play it down. His behavior after succumbing to the virus became even more imperious, First, he insisted on being paraded in a presidential drive past before supporters gathered outside the hospital. Then he choreographed a triumphant return to the White House, in which he came across as an American Il Duce, right down to the balcony scene at the end. This primetime spectacular looked more like bad comic opera, the apotheosis of his hypermasculine style. In private, Trump could be even more extreme than he was on Twitter. To deter immigrants from crossing the Mexican border, he suggested building an alligator moat stocked with venomous snakes, and that migrants could be shot in the legs to hamper their advance. Journalists, he said, should not merely be imprisoned, but eliminated. These people should be executed, he said. They are scumbags. When protesters gathered outside the White House at the height of the George Floyd protests, he asked his then Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something. Little of this should have come as a surprise, since one of the most blatant manifestations of his autocratic leanings was his uncontested, unconcealed adulation of despots, the Philippine presidents, Rodrigo Duterte, the Saudi prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Kim Jong-un, and his friend and hero, Vladimir Putin. I was travelling with Trump in 2019 when he invited the despot he once ridiculed as Little Rocket Man to join him in the demilitarised zone that separated the two countries. A meeting teed up by a presidential tweet, which gave it the feel of online dating. The impromptu summit also had the chemistry of a romantic reunion, no matter that the dictator's crimes included murder, enslavement, rape, torture, forced abortions, knowingly causing mass starvation, and carrying out executions with anti-aircraft guns and flamethrowers. In their aptly timed book, How Democracies Die, the Harvard academics Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt developed four behavioural warning signs to help identify an authoritarian. First, when a politician rejects the democratic rules of the game. Second, when he denies the legitimacy of opponents. Third, when he tolerates or encourages violence. And fourth, when he indicates a willingness to curtail the civil liberties of opponents, including the media. Prior to 2016, Nixon was the only modern president to meet any of those criteria. Within his first 100 days, Trump had ticked off all four. So if the evidence of Trump's authoritarianism was so overwhelming, why did we in the media not do more to call it out? Admittedly, it's a scratch I keep on itching. A problem for news organisations was that we were covering an abnormal presidency while trying to abide ourselves by normal rules of journalistic engagement. Likening a sitting president to a pre-war European dictator violated our behavioural norms. It crossed the line. Trump's attacks on the media, moreover, made impartiality even more of an imperative. He thrived when we became oppositional and adversarial. Nor did we want to follow him into the gutter, which is precisely where he wanted us to descend. The problem was that in trying to remain normal ourselves, we normalised him. Though we regularly use language such as jaw-dropping, unprecedented, unorthodox, mainstream correspondents were reluctant to reach for stronger speech, such as fascist or its diluted but still strong derivative, fascistic. Many of us were squeamish even about using the word lie to describe his thousands of falsehoods because it implied we could read his mind and be certain of intent. Similarly, we were hesitant about labelling him racist despite decades of incriminating evidence. Though frequently we reported on his admiration for authoritarians, we were not ready to lump Trump fully in with them. Institutional timidity also kicked in. The BBC Complaints Unit, a body independent of its news division, fanned against me when I described the 10 out of 10 score that Trump awarded himself for the handling of COVID as being amongst his ridiculous boasts. However, to say it wasn't ridiculous was ridiculous. The Complaints Unit also ruled that I'd overstepped the mark in speaking of Trump's narcissistic hunger for adoration and mind-bending truth-twisting. But again, both were incontrovertible. Additionally, it found that I'd broken the BBC's impartiality rules because my coverage of Trump, in the words of the ruling, was not offset by the limited and relatively restrained criticism of the Democrats, Joe Biden and Congress. But this was false equivalence gone mad. Both sides are even taken to the point of absurdity. In order to speak of Trump's ridiculous boast, was I really expected now to concoct equally ridiculous boasts from Biden and to cite evidence that did not exist? Evidently, our definition of impartiality has become so warped that we could no longer draw attention to Trump's flaws without suggesting a parity of wrongdoing with Joe Biden. Fearful of being seen as elitist and anti-populist, especially in the aftermath of Brexit, even as august an organisation as the BBC was sometimes hesitant about telling the full truth. This I say out of a sense of dismay rather than bitterness. I'm reluctant to levy criticism against an organisation I love. It's also worth pointing out again that I was up against the BBC Complaints Unit. The BBC News Division backed me to the hilt. But the effect of all this was to report Trump as a rogue president rather than an aspiring autocrat or, as he later became, a fully-fledged authoritarian. The effect of these kind of rulings was to impose a kind of self-censorship. Another analytical shortcoming of the media as a whole was our failure to properly excavate the past. All too often, we recycled the lazy cliché that Donald Trump was a president like no other. All too often, we disregarded or failed to explore the history that contradicted that storyline. Trump is not such an outlier as is ordinarily supposed. President Andrew Jackson, who served between 1829 and 1837, is the most obvious example. Dubbed King Andrew I, this brutal former general rode roughshod over Congress and has been likened by historians to an American Caesar. Donald Trump regards him as his presidential soulmate. His portrait hung in the Oval Office during his presidency. John Adams, the second president, tried to ban the opposition. Thomas Jefferson also subverted the spirit and letter of the Constitution. The boldest move of his presidency was also the most legally dubious, the Louisiana Purchase, which almost doubled the size of America. It was not just a land grab, but a power grab. In the early 20th century, Woodrow Wilson, a supposed paragon of progressive virtue, bordered on the despotic when faced with the twin threats of Imperial Germany and the Bolshevik Revolution. Even the saintly Abraham Lincoln was prepared to break the Constitution in order to save the Union. As the Civil War raged, Honest Abe ripped up the First Amendment by censoring the press and arbitrarily imprisoning thousands of political opponents, some merely for singing Confederate songs. Yet for all these transgressions, he resides still on his historical throne of grace. Back in the 1930s, when totalitarianism was rampant in Europe, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was frequently assailed for being an American dictator and for violating the unwritten convention set by George Washington that presidents should serve no more than two terms. So appalled was H.L. Mencken, the most famed journalist of his day, that he drafted a satirical constitution for the New Deal, which decreed all governmental power of whatever sort shall be vested in the President of the United States. Yet voters re-elected FDR three times, thus endorsing his norm-busting. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who suggested to her husband that he should become a benevolent dictator, noticed that the line from his 1933 inaugural address that drew the loudest cheers was his call for a strong presidency that would test the bounds of the Constitution. From George Washington onwards, there's always been an appetite for an American strongman. And journalists, in explaining the popularity of Trump, should not neglect that history. Our failure to properly look into the past exposed a large problem, a form of bias which was not liberal or conservative, but rather Whiggish. It borrowed from Thomas Macaulay's famous declaration that the history of England is emphatically the history of progress, something which came to be known as the Whig interpretation of history. It is what I call a better America bias, a presumption of progress predicated on the idea that US history is principally a parable of national self-improvement and advancement. Though as journalists we are prone to excessive negativity about the present, we are often guilty of excessive positivity about the past. I cannot stress strongly enough to any journalist in any country the need to steep themselves in as much history as they can. Indeed, the advice I used to give young correspondents pitching up at the BBC's bureau in Washington was to remember that America had fought a civil war in the mid-19th century and was still arguing over the terms of a fractious peace. much like the modern phrase, sorry, but not sorry, which is used sarcastically to indicate a lack of remorse. The brief ceremony which brought the armed fighting to an end was a surrender, but not a surrender. More than 150 years on, there is an extent to which we continue to live in the post-bellum era. Yet we continue to live in the pre-civil rights era as well, because so many of the issues that led to the breakup of the Union have never been fully resolved. That is why I would now amend my advice to those young journalists. The existence of two Americas long predates the Civil War. Division has always been the default setting. Victory at the Battle of Yorktown brought American independence, but it did not mean American nationhood was a given. Indeed, initially it was feared that two or three separate confederacies might be formed rather than a singular United States. All the clues that you need to decipher why America is so divided and why Trump's political style remains so popular are to be found in the pages of history. I also think it's worth revisiting the more recent past and to remind ourselves of the mistakes we made as an industry when covering his rise. Our coverage, especially in those early days, demonstrated how our news judgment is often warped by the modern-day metrics of news, ratings, likes, clicks. For back in 2016, it was not just the disused steel mills and derelict factories of the Rust Belt that became echo chambers of Trumpism. The media massively amplified the message as well. Indeed, Donald Trump came to be seen as the savior of our wreckage-strewn wasteland, a media landscape dotted with shuttered local newspapers, half-empty newsrooms, and dried-up revenue streams. Into these parched riverbeds, Trump threw a lifeline. At a time when online news sites and apps were desperate for traffic, he became the ultimate clickbait candidate. When cable channels were struggling to attract eyeballs, along came a ratings juggernaut. Attention had become the most valuable commodity of the digital age. Trump generated it in spades. Yet another irony of 2016 and our collective failure in predicting he would win the presidency was that an industry devastated by the new economy failed to fully comprehend how similar disruptive forces would upend politics. I don't believe that Trump mastered the art of the deal. His business skills have always been exaggerated, not least by him, but he's certainly mastered the art of attention. News executives echoed the words reportedly uttered by Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, at her Brooklyn headquarters whenever the billionaire appeared on screen. Shush, I've got to get me some Trump. The result was a form of relationship addiction, almost a textbook case study of codependency. An excessive reliance on a partner who requires support for an addiction or illness that ends up being one-sided, abusive, and destructive. On cable, he became the man not just of every hour, but every minute. Even when he wasn't on screen, CNN routinely broadcast an empty podium awaiting his arrival, next to a countdown clock indicating when he'd speak. On network television, the breakfast shows tore up their production values to allow Trump to appear on his mobile rather than the studio or via satellite, the kind of phoners ordinarily permitted only in the event of important breaking news. Trump inevitably prospered from one of the strongest forms of partiality in our industry, what I call better story bias. Back in 2016, who wanted to follow low-energy Jeb Bush, who sounded like he'd been tranquilized when Trump was holding a stadium rally in the next town? Why cover moderate candidates when the algorithms favored Trump's extremism? No other candidate offered anywhere near the same journalistic entertainment value or dopamine hit. So many modern media trends worked to his advantage, from cable channels who favoured outrage and confrontation, to the fact that so many journalists now virtually live their professional lives on Twitter. A medium Trump quickly mastered and conquered. He crowned himself the Ernest Hemingway of 140 characters. The Barnum and Bailey-like atmosphere surrounding the race, with Trump in the role of ringmaster, brought a stern rebuke from President Obama. I just want to emphasize the degree to which we are in serious times. And this is a really serious job, he said, from the podium of the White House press room. This is not entertainment. This is not a reality show. This is a contest for the presidency of the United States. But the president was swimming against a rip tide. The mood of the media industry was best summed up by Les Moonves, the former CBS president who was fired for sexually abusing female employees. "It may not be good for America," he said, "but it's damn good for CBS." Unquestionably, the media gave Trump a huge assist. But it's also worth remembering that by the time he ran for the presidency, the reality TV star was a one-man media conglomerate. In 2016, he could boast more Twitter followers than the traditional outlets like the Washington Post. The traditional gatekeepers of the news were no longer significant because there were no longer any gates. Few understood this better than Donald Trump. He knew that the future in politics belonged to those who generated their own content. He was the new media. I realise that this all now sounds like old news, but I would argue that it's worth revisiting because we're already repeating the same mistakes again. In the three-ring circus that is modern-day American politics, Trump remains the ringmaster. The mesmerising focus not just of the MAGA faithful, but the global media as well. His four separate arraignments in New York, Miami, Washington, and Atlanta became like a blockbuster summer franchise, with a new premiere seemingly every other week. The modern-day tools of news gathering mean that we can follow pretty much Trump's every move as he journeys from the gates of Mar-a-Lago to whichever courthouse he happens to be appearing in that day. But just because we can cover that doesn't mean we should cover that. Yet for ratings-chasing TV executives, Trump is still a tangerine dream. For news websites, he's clickbait gold. For commentators like me, he remains the gift that never stops giving. One trap that we are already falling into is the journalistic compulsion to balance negative coverage of Trump with equally negative coverage of Joe Biden, as if there needs to be a parity of negativity. Inevitably, then, we keep on returning to the issue of the president's age and mental state, a legitimate area of inquiry for sure, and one that I've written about at length. But the problem is that Biden's advancing years end up receiving a laser-like focus, whereas there's more of a strobe effect when it comes to Trump's 91 separate felony charges. This is precisely what happened in 2016, when Hillary Clinton's emails, with her email scandal, to demonstrate our impartiality and to offset coverage of Trump's myriad scandals, we kept on returning to her emails. When researchers crunched the numbers, they found that the email scandal received more sentences of coverage than all of Trump's misconduct combined. This gets us into another area of journalistic partiality that often gets overlooked. It's the problem of journalists being so sensitive to the charge of liberal bias that they end up overcorrecting by producing narratives with a conservative slant. I saw this happen in 2000 when Al Gore, who was arguably overqualified to be president, was held to a higher standard by liberal-minded reporters than George W. Bush, who was manifestly underqualified to be president. I'd also warn against caricaturing Trump's supporters. The temptation always, as a TV correspondent especially, is to put a microphone in front of the person you expect to say the most extreme things, which at a Trump rally is usually somebody wearing a MAGA cap with a T-shirt emblazoned with an image of Trump dressed as Rambo or the Terminator. But the more interesting Trump supporters are the well-dressed women who turn up at rallies sipping Starbucks lattes, or the small businessmen wearing sports casual. A lot of smart people vote for Trump, and that's something the media should never ignore. We shouldn't always pick the lowest hanging fruit, the weird apples, although sometimes this kind of restraint can come back to haunt you. A BBC colleague who was covering the aftermath of the 2020 election in Arizona decided that a pro-Trump protester outside a counting centre was simply too outlandish to speak to. He was wearing animal pelts and, get this, a horned helmet. Crazy stuff. His name was Jacob Chansley. And on January the 6th, he achieved global fame as the QAnon shaman. But the focus on the QAnon shaman in the aftermath of the insurrection spoke of yet another modern media pitfall, the habit of turning even the gravest of events into comedy, whether in the form of jokes on Twitter, a late-night monologue, a skit on Saturday Night Live, a meme on Instagram, or months later, a Halloween costume. This time around, we should also be less timid about calling Trump out. January the 6th brought his authoritarian tendencies to the fore. So let us not merely say that he is unconventional and norm-busting, but rather that he's an anti-democrat with dictatorial desires. I'm not suggesting that we liken him to Hitler, although there certainly are shades of Mussolini. But we should not be afraid to label him as an aspiring American autocrat. We should also be unafraid to draw parallels with the language of Hitler, which Trump evoked during the primary season when he made his racist claim that immigrants were poisoning the blood of America. Avoiding both sides-erism and all the journalistic cop-outs that go with it requires an editorial reframing. As Jay Rosen, a professor of journalism at New York University, recently commented, the central conflict in American politics has to shift from Democrats versus Republicans to the MAGA movement versus American democracy. Be truthful, not neutral, has become the mantra of CNN's veteran correspondent Christiane Amanpour. I'm not going to trot out the cliche that if somebody tells you it's raining and someone tells you it's sunny, then look out the window and find out for yourself, because journalism is rarely so simple. Sometimes the weather is patchy. Sometimes there isn't even a window on hand. But I would implore journalists to go where the facts lead without fear or favour. Covering Trump is not straightforward. As Ed Luce of the Financial Times recently put it, no matter what approach America's media takes to Trump, controversy is assured. Ignoring what he says is negligence. Running his speeches live is an in-kind subsidy. We need to be a lot more selective in what we cover, whether it's his cavalcades to the courthouse or his ranting stump speeches. We need to be equipped to fact-check him in real time, something which CNN, to its credit, has a dedicated correspondent to do. We also need to understand that facts, alas, do not always counter falsehoods. We're in the midst of an infodemic. Truth isn't always the antidote. So we should not just debunk the falsehoods that Trump utters, but pre-bunk them as well, to alert viewers ahead of time about some of the bogus talking points that he routinely uses, which have no basis in fact. We should not lose the capacity to be shocked by the shocking things he says. So frequently does Trump say outrageous things that they've almost ceased to have news value. But when a candidate trying to return to the most powerful job in the world says shocking things, they should always be front page news. Just as we should not succumb to Trump scandal fatigue, we should not succumb to Trump outrage fatigue. I'd also caution against what I call predictive bias. When a presenter or editor asks you to give your assessment of who is going to win an election, tell them you're a correspondent and not a clairvoyant. Making predictions, even off air or not in print, impacts the journalistic mind. It makes you look for evidence which confirms your prediction and to downplay evidence which suggests a different outcome. Reporting on what happened is hard enough. The modern-day journalistic trend of predicting what will unfold in 6 months' time, which we sometimes wear as a badge of our expertise and insider knowledge, should be avoided. And please let us not fall prey again for one of the strongest forms of partiality in journalism, the best story bias, which leads us to produce narratives which correspond with the storylines that we most want to cover. The somnolence of a Biden second term offers much less journalistic entertainment value than the chaos of a Trump restoration, the ultimate past-the-popcorn presidency. But at the heart of journalism should be the public good, not our amusement and professional pleasure. Often my mind goes back to the night of Trump's victory in 2016. I was assigned to cover Hillary Clinton's victory speech. They'd set up a stage in a convention center in Manhattan under a glass ceiling that she was figuratively supposed to smash. Early on in the evening, the mood was buoyant. Mentally, at least, members of her press team were popping the champagne corks. But then came the early numbers from key states such as Florida and Pennsylvania, and it quickly became clear that we were going to be reporting on the biggest electoral shock in American history. The press room that night was packed with hundreds of reporters, but the mood was strangely mute. Indeed, it was almost funereal. People paid to speak and write for a living struggled to come up with words. We also realised that we got the election terribly wrong. Had we got it right, we would have been over the Trump victory party a few blocks away in Midtown Manhattan. When our stories were filed and we eventually drifted off into the New York night, I vividly remember a young African-American wandering down the street and overhearing him tell a friend, "America has chosen hate." I also remember the words of a younger BBC colleague, which revealed a wisdom beyond his years. He predicted that a Trump presidency would require us as journalists to summon everything we had ever been taught and everything we had ever learnt on the job. A second Trump presidency, if that what eventuates, would confront us with an even tougher test, a maximal test. I hope that as an industry, we are better equipped to meet that challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick, for a fantastic speech, full of insight, also full of some of the horrors of Trump going back to 2016 that I'd actually forgotten about. So it was probably very good and instructive to be reminded of those. Now, after that fabulous and informative and entertaining speech, we have a fair bit of time now for question and answer. There's one down here.
Nick, thank you very much again for a sterling effort. As a scholar of JFK, together with the fabulous Larry Saberto, what's your opinion on the effect of the questionable, dubious and very scary character of RFK Jr.?
Kennedy was a great gateway for me into America. Often when I try and think, you know, my love of America has been such a continual thread in my life that I kind of have never really thought where the first stitch was sewn. And actually, it was as a young kid growing up in Birmingham, Britain's second city, and in the church where I attended as a kid, in this inner city part of Birmingham, there was a mosaic of Kennedy. It was in the underground, in the middle of a traffic island, the most awful of settings, really, but the most transcendent of mosaics for a sort of 3 or 4 year old kid looking up at this thing. I was actually transfixed by it. It was this staggeringly beautiful man addressing a multi-ethnic crowd with this gold thing behind him that looked like the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was the presidential seal. That staggeringly beautiful man was JFK. And the multi-ethnic crowd included Martin Luther King. And from that moment on, I became fascinated with the Kennedys. So I'm kind of interested with this idea that Robert Kennedy has sort of sullied the name of the, for many of us, certainly in the younger years, came to believe sort of summed up the best of America. You know, its youth, its dynamism, its sense of immigrant success. The Kennedy White House was a place of rationality and refinement. It was a place where the arts and the sciences came together. You know, he obviously had a staggeringly beautiful presidency. And so now it's interesting to see Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's obviously the nephew of JFK and the third child of RFK and Ethel Kennedy, being such a disruptive presence in this race. Now, the initial conventional wisdom was that he was going to hurt Trump more. RFK is this interesting character where the kind of left meets the right. You know, he's an environmentalist, so that appeals to the left, but he's also sort of put forward quite a lot of conspiracy theories, and he's an anti-vaxxer. And now, obviously, the conventional wisdom has completely changed, that he poses more of a threat to Joe Biden and that he's going to be taking votes away from him. And it underscores how difficult this election is to predict, and I'm certainly not going to make a prediction having said what I said, and it shows how just a very small shift in a few thousand votes in a few states is going to impact the outcome of this race. He is a disruptive figure. I'm constantly struck by how the Kennedys, which used to sort of inspire so many people and represent a kind of noble politics, have now been sort of dragged into this kind of craziness. You know, one of the conspiracy theories around QAnon is that JFK Jr. is really alive. Some people think he's Q himself, actually. And there was this remarkable moment a few years ago in Dealey Plaza, which is where Kennedy was killed in Dallas, where a whole crowd of QAnon supporters actually gathered because they believed that the JFK Jr., after years of being in hiding after his supposed death in 1999, was going to reemerge and that he would announce that he was going to be Donald Trump's running mate. And there were people there with T-shirts on with Trump Kennedy 2024. So, the emergence of RFK is a kind of parable about, you know, where America's gone in the last 60 years or so.
Okay, Nick, we have another question over here.
Hello. I'm an American Australian, American first. Then I moved over here and I became an Australian citizen. I grew up in New Jersey in the 70s and 80s, so I've known Trump for a long time. When he bought casinos in Atlantic City and they went bankrupt, we said, how the hell do you get a casino to go bankrupt.
Right.
Right. I mean, so we kind of knew he was a moron from the early ages. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I voted for Joe Biden. I still vote in the American elections over here. My question is this. Donald Trump's criminal trial for election interference, hush money, starts on U.S. Monday or Tuesday. Do you think he's scared? And second of all, what do you think are the odds of him being convicted?
Yeah, well, that's the New York case, isn't it? And it's probably the weakest of all the cases.
Actually, I think it's quite a strong documentary case, so I actually think it's quite a decent case.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, it's a slam dunk in terms of documentary evidence, but the problem is they're trying out this legal theory, aren't they? That they're, it involves a federal election and they're going through a state court. So there's a kind of legally, there's some grounds there where they believe that Trump can actually get away with that one. The problem is that might be the only trial that actually takes place before Election Day.
And it's also a state trial, so he can't, if he becomes president, he can't get rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. There's four in all, obviously. Two of them are state-based, which is Georgia and New York, and two of them are federal. Trump could pardon himself if he becomes president on the federal one. That's constitutionally dubious, by the way. It's by no means clear-cut. The Supreme Court would have to adjudicate on that one, but, you know, it's a Trump court, right? 6-3. Although they haven't always backed Trump on electoral cases, it should be said. Yeah, I'm worried that that might be the only trial that actually goes to court before the election, because the polls do show that if he is convicted of anything, his poll numbers will drop. A lot of people are voting for Nikki Haley who won't vote for Donald Trump. You know, there are a lot of sensible Republicans. You know, I thought the midterm elections 2 years ago demonstrated that, you know, there is a sensible majority in America that still believes in democracy. The question in this presidential election, of course, is whether those people are in the right states and vote in sufficient numbers.
Okay, there's a question over this side.
Hi, I'm also American, and...
Before you go, I should actually say, I should profess my love for America.
Thank you so
Everything
much.
Everything I say out of America comes from a deep love. I love your country. It breaks my heart to see what's happening there, to be honest. Many times in my adult life, I would have become an American citizen. I studied there as a student. I felt more at home in America, really, than I did in Britain, my homeland. I love the kind of animating possibility of America. I love the fact that there wasn't snobbery. I wonder the fact that, you know, people said, I want to be that, I want to do that job. And they really believe they could do it, which is very different from growing up in Britain. So, sorry, I've interrupted you, but I just wanted to say
That's
to all
okay.
the Americans in the audience, I love your country.
Thank you. I welcome the rare American love and appreciation. So in the modern day media landscape, people can pick and choose what news they consume to create kind of these like cherry-picked echo chambers. Mm. So as a journalist, how do you confront the reality that while you can diligently report the truth, those that may need to hear it most will refuse to consume it? And does that ever trouble you as a journalist?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's a really big challenge for our industry. I mean, at the BBC, we thought about this long and hard for many years. And it's a challenge that everybody faces, wherever you are in the world. You know, one of the key things I think we need to try and do is to attract new audiences, to get people young. The BBC's done a lot of work in trying to sort of retailer its news so it's popular on the forum, which young people get their news from now, which is, you know, TikTok and Snapchat and Twitter. And, well, not even Twitter, actually. Twitter's pretty middle-aged now, isn't it? And even Instagram's pretty middle-aged, right? I mean, it's really hard to keep up with what are the latest trends and what are the latest fads. But, you know, we've got to go hunting for those people. They're not going to come to us anymore automatically. I mean, when I was growing up in Britain, you know, there wasn't really much media choice at all when it came to broadcast media. You kind of listened to the BBC, mostly. We just can't take that for granted anymore. And so we have to try and, you know, get those people listening to our news before, you know, they become infected by the infodemic that is raging and so contagious elsewhere.
And we've got a question at the front now.
Yeah, hi. I was born in Finland and I'm an Australian, and I have been wondering that it seems to be that all our, I'm a journalist myself too, our mainstream media is against Trump. And yet everybody is speculating that he most likely will be rechosen. I just wonder, would there be any positive effect if he would be re-chosen? Could you see anything positive coming out of Donald Trump being again a president? Thank you.
That's a great question. Look, I mean, a lot of people thought that Trump was going to be a warmonger, and he wasn't. Trump didn't start any new wars, right? So we'll give him that. And a lot of NATO countries have ended up stumping a lot more cash for NATO because they're worried, you know, Trump harangued them into doing it. Obama had tried to harangue them into doing him as well, frankly, but Trump just did it in a lot more aggressive way. You know, you could cite that as a positive. You know, a lot of people thought the Trump presidency, Mark I, wasn't as damaging to the international order as some people had feared. I mean, you know, I was at the UN a lot during the Trump years, and I remember talking to Antonio Guterres once, who's the Secretary General of the UN, and he basically said to me, Trump could kill the UN with a single tweet. But he didn't, so you could cite that. One of the reasons he didn't actually was because Nikki Haley was a UN ambassador at the time, and she really made the case for the United Nations, and she really got Trump on board. So, yeah, I mean, talking about impartiality, I mean, you've clearly got to kind of approach everything with an open mind on this. You know, I'm not going to say everything that Trump does is bad. What I've been trying to say in the lecture, obviously, is when he does do the bad stuff, we've got to report it. And we've got to call that out. And we can't be kind of mealy-mouthed about it. We've got to use stronger language than we did last time. And we've got to tell the full truth, yeah.
Okay, Nico, time's just about up, but I've seen there's a couple of people have had their hands up.
Your take on the implications for Trump presidency, second Trump presidency for the UK and for Australia would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'd worry about AUKUS. I mean, Trump's transactional, and I think maybe he'll see in AUKUS a deal that is actually really good for American industry. But at the same time, any deal that wasn't negotiated by Donald Trump is a bad deal. So I think the international order would again face a really big stress test, as would the US Constitution at home. I mean, Ukraine, I mean, Putin would roll into Ukraine. I don't think Trump would continue American assistance. I think that would have a massive impact, obviously, on China and Taiwan. You know, and so it's deeply worrying. And the international order would certainly see a bigger test than it did do in the first Trump presidency. Trump was surrounded in the first Trump presidency by people trying to stop him being the kind of full Trump. You know, there were some grown-ups in that room. There were some internationalists. There were people who really valued the alliance system that America's developed over the years, which is the source of so much of its strength. And they were moderating influences on Trump. He's made it very clear that in the second term, he will surround himself by lawless, and there won't be those moderating influences. And the threat to the world order, the international order, will be much greater.
Okay, on that note, let's thank Nick not only for the lecture but for fielding so many questions.
On Big Ideas, journalist, author, former BBC US correspondent Nick Bryant, delivering the 2024 Brian Johns Lecture at the State Library of New South Wales. And if be truthful, not neutral, seems like good advice, it will surely still spark debate over the role of reporters in covering election campaigns. Big thanks to Macquarie University and the Copyright Agency for that talk. That's it from us. Thanks to the Big Ideas team, Karin Zivanovits, Claire Slattery. Our sound engineer is David LeMay, and I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can find Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app. Be sure to download that to your phone, and that way you can follow all our episodes. I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.